Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. If you want to know what the job of an analyst for the CIA is like, think about the character Jack Ryan from the Tom Clancy books. Always the smartest yet unrecognized person in the briefing. Then connecting the dots that no one else could see and flying off to exotic locales to personally become involved on the sharp end of the spear. When you're done, you celebrate with a well-earned drink and sumptuous meal surrounded by Special Forces personnel with Call of Duty-like nicknames. Kind of. Well, not really. Especially the sumptuous meal part. I'm guessing that in reality, an analyst's life can be quite different. Lots of time surfing the internet and writing reports. Lots and lots of reports. However, on occasion, life can get rather Jack Ryan-esque, as you will hear from our guest today on American Warrior Radio. She served as an analyst for both the Defense Intelligence Agency and the Central Intelligence Agency. She's got a new book out called In the Dark of War, a CIA officer's account of the U.S. evacuation from Libya. Sarah Carlson, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on.
Well, it's a thrill, and we don't get a Jill Ryan on the show very often.
Oh, I appreciate it. I will take that.
Now, in fairness, the comparison between you and Jack Ryan, not quite as glamorous, or?
I would say not quite as glamorous, but he is one of the few analysts really depicted in Hollywood, so it's kind of fun to tell people, you know, if they want to know kind of most closely what an analyst does, then check out the Jack Ryan films or TV show now.
Well, I want to encourage our listeners to check out your new book, In the Dark of War. It's a very intriguing read. Sarah, let's talk about the process of publishing the book, though. I've had a number of guests on the show, former CIA agents, Special Forces folks who had to go through that grinder of approvals. The most ridiculous I can remember most recently, I had one of the Navy SEALs who was involved in the mission that got bin Laden. But the final copy of his book, all throughout the book, the name SEAL Team 6 was redacted, as if everybody in the world didn't know that that's who that was. In your case, I think you actually had to file a lawsuit, didn't you, to get published?
I did, and in my book, I don't have redactions. I was not allowed to use them, so I actually had to find alternate language that I could use. So that's why in mine, some things are a little bit vague. But that's the reason for that. And mine was, I think, kind of a worst-case scenario of getting it cleared. So I first submitted my book to the CIA Publication Review Board back in October 2015, and it is just now getting published. And in between, we sort of went back and forth a few times, and then they approved it, and then my literary agent asked me to add in more about, you know, like my background and through my thoughts about like the Benghazi attacks in 2012. And so I added that information in and then sent it back to the review board. And at that point, they decided that the entire manuscript in any form that it ever was entirely classified. So I had to hire a lawyer because obviously things like my childhood are not classified.
Right.
It just was a process, and that was as much to protect myself as anything because I'd already sent out versions of the manuscript to my literary agent. So, I was concerned because I'd already sent it, and if they now considered it classified, I didn't want to get in trouble. So hired the lawyer, and it actually, once he filed the lawsuit, it turned around pretty quickly. They said they, you know, might have been a little hasty and just wanted to look at it again. So I sent it back, and then they had a few more tweaks that they wanted to make. But otherwise, they approved it in full, and then it was just the process of, you know, editing and everything. So it ended up being about 5 years start to finish.
Do you know how that compares to other authors of your writing in your vein? Longer, shorter, about right?
Much longer.
Okay. All right.
I think other people have had, challenges as well, but I can only guess. We never really know why it's difficult to review some things and not others. But at the time, you know, I submitted mine in 2015, and it was about Libya, and of course, Libya was very controversial because of the Benghazi attacks, and we were heading into an election. So I think all the different things combined just kind of slowed it a bit on getting that approval.
Well, I'll tell you what, Sarah, like you, we here at American Warrior Radio are patriots, so if there's something that I ask that you have to say no comment to or something else, I'll understand. Ben gets at least one dumb question a show. Those are my only rules, so bear with me. Now, one thing, Sarah, you have in common with other guests we've had on American Warrior Radio was the impact that the September 11th attacks had on your choice and movement in your career. As I understand it, you were interning in college on 9/11, and tell us what it was about those attacks that moved you in the direction you are now.
Yes, I was entering for emergency management, and that is in fact where I am again working. So it's coordinating with first responders to respond to disasters and like currently the coronavirus, the pandemic. So at the time I was interning, and the office that I interned with sponsored the FEMA urban search and rescue team. And so I was able to help them get ready to go to New York City after the attacks. And so I was there, the day they happened, getting everything ready to help them get out. And they were going to try to help search for any survivors, which unfortunately there weren't. So they, it really affected me. I wanted to do something sort of on the national level. And then having seen that and felt that and been involved in it, being able to respond and to actually do something, I really wanted to do more of that. I had this great sense of service that I think my mother really instilled in us, and my brothers as well. I have three brothers, and all three of them joined the military after the attacks. And I talked to my boss at the time, who was a retired colonel, and he told me about DIA. And, of course, that was really appealing because my brothers had joined defense. So I applied and ended up getting that job. And I very much wanted to do counterterrorism, again, because of the 9/11 attacks, that sense of wanting to protect the people I loved in our country. And so I ended up doing counterterrorism as well. So my entire career, which is about 12 and a half years, was all counterterrorism.
Now, sir, a lot of folks, everybody's heard of the CIA, but not very many people are familiar with the DIA. Could you explain briefly to our listeners what that organization is and what they do?
Yes, it's similar-ish in that it is an intelligence agency. So our intelligence community is made up of more than a dozen different agencies that all contribute to the intelligence that informs our national security. And now the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, is sort of at the head. And so Defense Intelligence Agency is one of those, and it's more focused on the military and supporting the military. So anything from sort of very tactical, like when I was in Baghdad, I was supporting different military units there, and providing analysis, and if they had questions about, more tactical, like neighborhood by neighborhood, what they might encounter, then I would work with them on that. And then it all went all the way up to the Pentagon, to the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Secretary of Defense, so we were writing products to support them directly.
Sarah, I've heard that part of the reason you chose to pursue a civilian avenue was because you wanted to retain the option to say no, but nonetheless, throughout your career, it's apparent you just volunteered for a lot of stuff. When we come back, I want to talk about your next step. You mentioned Baghdad. So you go into the DIA, you get a whole week of weapons and driving training, and then they ship you off to a war zone. We'll hear more about that with Sarah Carlson when we come back, folks. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're chatting with Sarah Carlson. She's got a great new book out called In the Dark of War, a CIA officer's account of the U.S. evacuation from Libya. Sarah, we earlier mentioned that after 9/11, your whole family, reinforcing your tradition of military service, everybody signed up, your three brothers, I think two Army, one Air Force, and you went the civilian route, but you were the first to get deployed.
I was. I was in Baghdad within 6 months of starting, so I have this anecdote in my book that I was able to tell them that I deployed by sending them a picture of me holding my M4. So That's one of the few photos I actually have of me serving overseas and actually holding a weapon. And, you know, I printed them out because at the time, this was back in 2003, and, you know, we didn't have as much access to the internet or phones or anything. So I mailed them to my mom, and then she mailed them to each of my brothers where they were still in training.
Now, sir, I don't mean to belittle our government, but a week of weapons training, that's just about enough to learn which end is the dangerous end.
Yes,
not very Jack Ryan.
No. Luckily, because I come from a military background with my family, I am familiar with weapons. So I think I was a little more fortunate than some of my colleagues where I felt very comfortable in that kind of training. And actually, my stepfather taught us a variety of different kinds of weapons. So, like, I took my bow, I shoot archery, and, you know, we do throwing knives and stuff like that. So I think I was more fortunate than most in that I was already pretty comfortable with that. But I will say we shot thousands of rounds. So we were firing, so it was, with the DIA, it was like a 6 hour and a Beretta, and we were firing thousands of rounds. And then we also trained on the M4. So it wasn't, it was a pretty intensive week. I'll just say that.
Well,
it was a lot.
I take it back. Bows and throwing knives. You're not Jill Ryan. You're Jill Bourne. Maybe. Come on. There's no reason radio can't be fun, sir. Now, walk us through, describe to us what a, you know, I kind of joked about the role of an analyst, and you were technically a targeting analyst. What does that job entail?
So for most of my career, I focused on terrorist groups that were plotting attacks against the homeland, so against the U.S. or against Europe. And that was really the bulk of my focus most of the time. And targeting was looking just in more detail at things. So as an analyst, it's a lot of reading, a lot of reading. So I got really good at speed reading, you know, sort of like skimming through first sentence of every report and then, you know, like quickly finding like the little nuggets that are really important that stand out that need to know to focus on. And then writing and briefing. And so I think those are skills. I had an English degree and I was sort of teased about what I was going to use that for. But actually it was really useful as an analyst because there was so much reading and writing. And then learning those communication skills and briefing, we had to do everything from like, you know, 5 minute update on any given topic to, you know, like a member of Congress to, you know, like an hour with a combatant commander. So you had to know how to tailor it to your audience and then also make sure that they were able to understand the information you were trying to convey. So I think it's really easy to try to tell somebody, you know, what you think or what you believe, but it's another thing to try to get them to understand why. And so that was what I really tried to focus on and do as an analyst.
And really, as we proceed in our conversation, you mentioned Benghazi and then, of course, the evacuation from Tripoli that you're involved in. I would guess another big challenge is to convince them why they should take action. I mean, they've got to believe you, right?
Yes. And so as an analyst, though, as with CIA, it was we were not allowed to be policy prescriptive. So that means that we avoided at all costs trying to tell somebody what to do. And so it was more about presenting options. So like this terrorist group wants to attack here. Here's what it means. Here's how we could disrupt it. And it was more about presenting options. And we could say, like, if they asked, we could say, you know, what might be the best option, but it was definitely not about telling somebody what to do, but just making sure that they were informed.
Interesting. Okay, so here's maybe Ben's dumb question or the first I can't comment question for Sarah. Once upon a time, there was some knucklehead who stuffed a bomb in his underwear and got on a plane and tried to blow the plane up. He thankfully was not successful. What was the weirdest plot that you have come across, if you can mention that? I mean, I guess things get a little bizarre.
That's a pretty weird one, though, right?
Yeah.
I think that one kind of takes the cake. You know, there were a lot of different ones where there is a lot directed against, like, airlines and transportation, right? Anything from, like, why we still have to take off our shoes when we fly, to, you know, we can't carry liquid still. And all of that comes from something, from a plot that was disrupted. And those are two that I think people are more familiar with. But, they get really creative with how they try to smuggle, you know, weapons and bombs into a particular location.
So the transition, Sarah, before we lead to the next subject, your transition from the DIA to the CIA, when did that happen and why?
So when I was with the DIA, I actually did a lot of different things. So we were able to do a lot of like rotations or assignments elsewhere. So after I returned from Iraq, from Baghdad, I went to the National Counterterrorism Center. And I did a couple years there, and then I actually went to NORTHCOM, which is in Colorado Springs, and did there. And then when I was heading back to D.C. is when I applied to CIA and was able to get the position there. So it was, I'd say, like, I was at DIA, but actually about 4.5 years with it was doing those different, like, deployments or rotations somewhere else.
And what was the main difference that you noticed, Sarah, between the two? Because I think I read an interview or saw an interview with you. You said, you know, before you were coming, you were speaking as Sarah Jill Bourne, the defense analyst. But now you're walking in with CIA on your business card. And that's a little different, I'm guessing, for some folks.
It's very powerful. And even at DIA, it wasn't so much that it was just, you know, speaking as me, Sarah Carlson, it was still speaking on behalf of Defense Intel, but I think there's just a lot more weight behind CIA that just means something different. And they spend a lot of time training. So even though I had already served as an analyst for 5 years, I still went through the CIA analytic training. It's called CAP. And so it's like 3 months, I want to say. I can't remember exactly now, but 3 months of training to learn how to be an analyst the CIA way. And so, like, when you come out of that, it's, like, very empowering to be able to speak on behalf of the agency. And it just has a lot of weight behind it in a way that nothing else really does.
Okay, let's because I want to talk about, obviously, the heart of your book, but let's sort of plant the seeds here. So if folks, they should know, but the Arab Spring started, I think, in Tunisia, Egypt, Syria, Bahrain, eventually Libya. That led to Muammar Gaddafi's death in 2011. Sarah, this may not be a fair question, but there's bad people in the world. And on the scale of bad guys, after we bombed his tent and some other things, I mean, Gaddafi, he kind of went underground a little bit, didn't he? I mean, he wasn't as bad as some of the other bad guys out there. Or am I missing something? Were they still training folks and sending them around the world to do bad stuff?
Before the revolution, you mean?
Correct. I'm just in that little window where he kind of saw the light.
Under it was during Bush's presidency where Bush really had started to reach out and Gaddafi had agreed to start decommissioning some of, like, the local weapons plants and pay reparations for some of the attacks. But, you know, Libya has a long history of supporting terrorism. They were a state sponsor for quite a while, and they were making strides towards that end. But then when the Arab Spring happened and the revolution started in Libya, that definitely changed things.
Well, and for those history geeks like myself, you say a long time. I mean, all you have to do is listen to the Marine battle hymn, you know, the shores of Tripoli. Those were the Barbary pirates out of Tripoli back in, what, 1800s?
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, Sarah, when did you actually arrive in Tripoli, 2013?
Yes, I got there in July 2013, so sort of between, you know, when I was in Baghdad, I was traveling in and out of the region, so, like, Middle East and North Africa. So Before I actually went to Libya, I learned Arabic, and so that definitely helped with that position that I had there. And got there in July 2013, so it was a few months after the Benghazi attacks. And, you know, like my main goal after that happened was to try to prevent that from happening again.
Okay, perfect place to take a pause again, Sarah, because when I come back, I mean, one of the things that really struck me is that short time after the Benghazi attacks, and we're still feeding people into Libya, it struck me as a little bit odd, but you'll be able to educate us on that. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking to Sarah Carlson. She's got a great book out called In the Dark of War, A CIA Officer's Account of the U.S. Evacuation from Libya. Quite a harrowing account. You'll hear more when we come back. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're chatting with Sarah Carlson. She's got a book out, a brand new book out. I think literally, well, you've got the hard cover just literally got those, what, in the last few days, Sarah?
Yeah, it just came out June 23rd.
Perfect, perfect. Well, our timing's not that bad. The name of the book is In the Dark of War, A CIA Officer's Account of the U.S. Evacuation from Libya. Sarah, one thing that I had a little trouble wrapping my mind around, and I guess, I mean, it's government, right? But the Benghazi attacks happened, and why did we still even have people in Libya at that point in time? I know we don't like to run from a fight, but...
I think there was this sense that, you know, like it was the last administration, right? The Obama administration had been sort of the main proponent behind the intervention and having NATO go in and like help with the campaign against Gaddafi. And so I think that the administration felt a lot of responsibility to follow through. And, you know, even when I was there and towards the end when we were getting like the bombing campaign was going on, there was still sort of that mantra of like, we will not lose Libya, we will not fail. So after the Benghazi attacks happened, we had folks in Benghazi and then also in Tripoli. They're actually quite far apart, so they're about, I'm going to say, like 6-hour drive and a few hour flight. So it's not that close. It'd be like going to a different state, but, you know, same country, actually. And I think they were sort of relying on the fact that there was that distance there, and then also the importance of, you know, knowing what was going on in the country. So,
sure. Okay.
I think that's why they say, of course, you know, I don't know. And I know that I still wanted to go because of the importance I saw in it from a terrorism perspective. So, like, we knew Al-Qaeda had been looking at it to use as a platform to launch operations against Europe. The Libyan involvement in terrorism, as I already mentioned, goes back, you know, decades, and they were heavily involved in, like, helping and supporting and leading Al-Qaeda. And so that was where a lot of my interest came from. But, of course, it's also very different, like, CIA's mission is very different from, say, State Department's mission, and so there's also that aspect.
Well, during your time there, Sarah, you—I'm assuming you left the compound gates on occasion, or maybe all every day. What was the sense you were getting from the Libyan people, just your average man or woman on the streets?
The feeling certainly shifted throughout the year when I was there. So when I first got there, it was more supportive. I stand out very much. I'm tall and blonde and blue-eyed, and you know, it wasn't safe by any stretch of the imagination, but I didn't feel as threatened when I first got there as I did near the end. Like, near the end, I actually had an incident where I was held at the airport for a while, which was quite scary, and I wasn't sure if I was going to be held hostage or kidnapped or something. But in the beginning, people were more open to talking and sort of wanting to meet with the Americans and share information. And with the ambassador, met with like all levels of the Libyan government. And so there was quite a lot going on in the beginning. And then as the situation continued to devolve, it became very hostile towards all Americans. And we were frequently the target of like kidnapping threats. And then that same group who conducted the Benghazi attacks, I was watching them as, you know, as the CIA analyst. and really trying to monitor, like, where they were operating and if they were coming to Tripoli. And, you know, as the year progressed, I saw them coming closer and getting into Tripoli. And so that was deeply concerning to me because that really set the stage to allow another Benghazi-type attack to happen.
Right. They had a track record. Let's kind of fast forward then up to July 26, 2014, I think was the official date, Sarah. At some point, somebody makes a decision, okay, enough. It's getting a little sporty down here. It's time to pull folks out. It's interesting to me, Sarah. We had Tig Tegan on the show, who was there at Benghazi. And there's a scene in the movie where not Tig, but someone basically tells the, I guess it was a State Department station chief there, no, now you're in my world. I'm in charge. This has become a military operation. But the final decision, or a lot of those final decisions there in Tripoli came down to the ambassador, Deborah Jones, right?
Yes. She made the ultimate choice on, like, what route we were going to take. And we were making recommendations. Like, I was meeting with her on a daily basis, briefing her on, like, status of forces and current threats and things like that. And so she was very much aware. I know she was because I was telling her. And it ultimately was up to her to decide on the route, but it was up to the administration to decide on the evacuation. So it came from the president, all the way from the top.
And I've never met Ambassador Jones, so I don't want to but I don't see anything in her background involving logistics or the military or, shouldn't folks like you or the Marines or somebody be more, I don't know. I forget about that. Let's move on. So the decision has been made. It's time to pull out. And this is a point where real life does reflect the movies. I mean, the burn barrels are lit up, shredders are working overtime, and you're putting nails through hard drives.
Yes, and I would say to your previous point, we had the Marines there with us who, it was actually a combat unit. After the Benghazi attacks, they assigned a combat unit to us. And the Marine captain, finally, at one point in one of these briefings, he was like, you know, ma'am, it is not an effective defense to duck from a bomb. So, you know, it was really quite pointed there at the end. But it did get very much like in the movies. So the militias were fighting each other. They weren't, it wasn't a direct attack against us, but they were firing pretty indiscriminately, so we were getting hit. And then once we got that evacuation order that we were going to go, we had about a day and a half to destroy everything. So we had this huge destruction fire going, and we were like running nails through hard drives and shredding anything paper. It didn't matter if it was like blank paper, we were shredding it just to make sure that there was nothing there.
And that's pretty standard CIA embassy protocol. I mean, not very sophisticated, but effective, I guess.
Yeah, I think, you know, we had time to be a little more thorough, so we were. We had about a day and a half, so it was literally, like, anything in our rooms, anything personal we had. We wanted to make sure that there wasn't any, like, personally identifying information. So, you know, that was one of the things I'm really careful about in the book, too, is protecting identity. So, I mean, the ambassador is a little bit different because she's a public figure, and then me. But otherwise, I tried, like, above and beyond to protect who was there with me.
What, Sarah, so the decisions, there's a long way from making the decision to actually implementing it. And the kind of walk, the decision was, why did you not fly out? Explain to our listeners why that, I mean, because that seems like an easy answer, but you're in the middle of the Civil War.
Yeah, flying would have been the easiest option, and in fact, that was our, we had been planning for an evacuation since Benghazi, so we had a lot of, you know, like plan A, plan B, plan C. Most of them involved air transport of some kind. The reason that we couldn't do that is because there was so much anti-aircraft artillery being fired. So there were hundreds of rockets being fired a day. All the other, like mortars and 14.5. And in addition to that, there was like the small arms clashes and the fighting like on the streets in downtown Tripoli. And, they were hitting the biggest thing was the first target was the airport. So Tripoli International Airport. We didn't know the status of the runway after that. We knew they were hitting the planes because you could see the, like the, they were on fire and the smoke billowing and everything. So we couldn't use the airport, and we had landing zones identified, but, you know, they were really worried about flying into AAA airspace. So then we started looking at overland options.
And the option, so we're moving 150 people overland to Tunisia, I think, right?
Yeah, we ended up going to Tunis. So there was a Tunis, Tunisia. So there was a coastal road that was the shortest option. I think people assumed that's the way we took. We never said before. I think this is the first time that it's come out that we actually took a long way. The reason we didn't do the shorter route was because we had had an incident where we'd had military members held hostage along that road that during the year. And then a couple of the other evacuations, so that all of the foreign embassies left, and so, like, the Russian embassy had run into trouble on that road. The British embassy actually ran into trouble on that road. So we decided to rule it out, and we ended up going south through Libya and then kind of coming up from the bottom of Tunisia and then all the way through the country.
And just for our listeners, so they can appreciate this, you're driving through a country that is at war with itself, but not hardly anybody's wearing uniforms. And by the way, we're Americans, and, you know, we've been dropping bombs and shooting missiles, and so you're not very popular.
No, we stood out a lot. And then by that time, too, I knew that Ansar al-Sharia had entered Tripoli and was cooperating with one of the militias that was involved in this fighting. And so I was really worried that they were going to use it as cover to attack our facility directly, very much like what happened in Benghazi. So it was on my mind. When we left, when we finally pulled out of the gate, I fully expected to be ambushed. I truly thought that we would not all make it out alive.
Well, Sarah, we're glad you did. When we come back, ladies and gentlemen, Sarah Carlson is going to give us tips on what to pack for evacuating a civil war-torn country when you've got a target on your back, including how many grenades you should put in the glove box. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Benjula Garcia. We're chatting with Sarah Carlson, the author of In the Dark of War, a CIA officer's account of the U.S. evacuation from Libya. And, Sarah, I want people to buy the book and read. Yeah, we don't want to give too much away about that harrowing little journey that you took, but you had been briefing the security personnel there, so you got to know them pretty well, I'm guessing, and they must have really trusted you quite a bit, because when it comes time to load up in the vehicles, you were given kind of a seat of honor.
Yes, I was a designated tactical commander of my vehicle on the convoy out. So it was, scary, but also quite an honor. And I was responsible for keeping, the people in my vehicle alive and getting them to safety.
And how many grenades do you recommend one places in the glove box, Sarah?
So we went with six. There were, I think, two incendiary, two like the smoke ones, and then two of the more traditional explosive ones. And they were showing me this, so that the security officer was driving my vehicle, and he's like, "So we have grenades in the glove box." And I'm like, "Yeah, I don't know how to use a grenade. I missed that training."
But they let you stay in the front right seat.
Yeah. He gave me a quick crash course on how to use them. And, I think it was just building up that trust throughout the year. I think, one of the things that kind of came across in 13 hours that was really quite different for me is what happened in Benghazi. It seemed like there was, tension between the security officers and, the CIA analysts. And for me in Tripoli, I worked really hard to create that trust. I was briefing them all the time, became really good friends with them. They would invite me to, work out with them. They invited anybody to work out with them. And I was like, sure, why not? So joined them. And I think a lot of that stuff just really helped build rapport and build that trust. So when it really came down to it, when it really mattered, they looked to me to help. And that was quite an honor.
At that point, Sarah, and you've got air cover, and it's not just your convoy. You've got eyes in the skies and other support. But what kind of a mix of people are we talking about? I mean, you're CIA. We've got former Special Forces folks providing security. I assume you have some State Department people sprinkled in there, some NSA. Sort of a fruit salad of agencies are all loading up into these vehicles, yeah?
Yep, and the Marines as well, who were there with us. So we had sort of a lead vehicle and a follow vehicle that were security officers and me. And then some of the vehicles in the middle were some of the other folks that were there with the embassy. So we were in sections, and so each section kind of went on their own so that if one was ambushed, the entire convoy wouldn't be compromised.
What? Hopefully none of us will experience what you experienced, but, I mean, you're... Because I've had other guests on that talk about really the danger of checkpoints and just how many things that can go wrong at a checkpoint. What are you doing to... I mean, we're talking a tense drive, Sarah. What are you doing to lighten the mood? Or is that verboten? Are you telling jokes or...?
A little bit, but nothing too heavy, right? So we needed to focus on what was going on around us. So it was just sort of like chit-chat. So one of the other people in my vehicle really liked music. He was an NSA representative there. And so he and I, you know, were just talking about our favorite bands and stuff like that. And then food, I think anybody who's ever deployed anywhere, this has come up, like, what's your first meal when you get back? So stuff like that. It wasn't anything too deep because our focus needed to be on what was outside the vehicle. But it helped to sort of break some of that tension.
Now, Sarah, this is something that is odd, interesting, but so, you know, I mentioned the different agencies involved. You mentioned the tensions in Benghazi. There was, when you finally get out and there's ice-cold water, and the reason I teased about the sumptuous meals, let's just say that certain members of our government staff treated you like a second-class citizen a little bit.
Yeah, they did. And I, you know, I didn't mean it to be, like, petty. It was really quite traumatic at the time that I'd risked my life to, you know, save these people, and they weren't grateful and sort of treated us poorly, and that was really offensive.
Well, and it's very odd because normally, because that was my reaction, Sarah, is like normally when a group, no matter how diverse, goes through a traumatic and a stressful event like that, the bonding becomes stronger. But, well, again, they'll have to read the book. What were your feelings when you finally got across that border and got a sense that you were safe? What was the first thoughts that went through Sarah Carlson's mind?
It was a huge relief, of course, but I also knew we still had quite a ways to go before we were done. And so we couldn't really relax too much yet. But there was absolutely, you know, a huge sigh of relief that we made it to Tunisia. We still ended up having many hours to go. So it actually was about 26 hours from start to finish. So we made it to, we left at like 5 a.m.-ish. And then we got to the border. It was still daylight. So it was probably around like 3 or 4 in the afternoon. So it wasn't that late. But we didn't get to Tunis until around 7 o'clock the next morning. So it actually was pretty, like, it was still quite a long way to go.
Sure. What, I mean, call it an evacuation. I wouldn't call it a retreat necessarily, but... That had to be, I mean, given what you'd invested and your hopes for the people of Libya, that had to be kind of a letdown, I guess, maybe.
Oh, yes, it was very much so. And like when we finally got to Tunis and we could sort of breathe again and you know, really kind of think about what had happened, I had a really hard time with it. I knew that, you know, we had invested so much into the revolution, into the intervention, what happened in Benghazi. You know, people literally died for this mission. I've given up so much of my life and, you know, blood and sweat and tears. And it was hard. It felt like we lost, whether we did or not. You know, it felt that way. It felt like we gave up. And that was really quite hard to reconcile.
And was that really part of the motivation or what was on your mind that when you made the decision to go ahead and leave the CIA?
Absolutely. I think people don't talk so much about like post-traumatic stress and what all goes into that. And I have no problem doing that. Like I think it's weirder if people went through something like that and didn't feel anything after, right? So I had a really hard time with it, that trying to reconcile what I went through and then still trying to be objective as an analyst. I couldn't do that anymore. I very much had a strong opinion. And then, you know, dealing with the aftermath, and while I was there, I was so busy and so focused on my job and what I was doing, I didn't really have time to process anything. So that processing came after, and that's when I really just decided I needed to leave. I needed to move on.
Sarah, we've only got a couple minutes left, but I want to take advantage of having your expertise here. When we were doing the pre-brief, I talked about, you know, kind of the idea of you break it, you bought it. Libya is still not healed. You wrote a commentary piece, 2017, in War on the Rocks, that you basically say Libya can't save itself. What, I mean, if you were to look with the benefit of hindsight and looking in the crystal ball, what, is this ever going to get fixed? Is it up to the people? And, I mean, should we have intervened? I don't know, lots of questions, but what is Sarah's take? What's your briefing for General BBG right now on Libya?
I think the problem won't be solved as long as there's so much foreign intervention still going on. So you have a lot of different countries supporting one side and a lot of different countries supporting the other side. And as long as it's basically this proxy war now, and as long as that's going on, the problem won't be solved. So I think, you know, like the UN Security Council, it needs to be a decision to support one or the other, or to bring that country together. But having so many countries supporting those opposing sides, they're, you know, just funneling money and weapons and everything. And it could go on forever if that keeps happening.
Just what we need.
No. No, not at all. But, you know, I don't think there's an easy solution. Just like, you know, with Afghanistan, it's soul crushing that we're, you know, negotiating with the Taliban. Like that's really hard to think about, and to know that that's happening while, you know, they're still killing people. We still have soldiers dying there, and you know, I don't think there are easy solutions, but that is deeply offensive as well. You know, and I don't want to see that happen in Libya either.
Sarah, I appreciate your time with us. I want to just leave our guests with a very powerful introduction to your book. You have a quote, "Think, too, of the great part that is played by the unpredictable in war. Think of it now before you actually commit to war. The longer a war lasts, the more things tend to depend on accidents. Neither you nor we can see into them. We have to abide their outcomes in the dark." Sarah Carlson, thank you so much for spending time with us, folks. Buy In the Dark of War, a CIA officer's account of the U.S. evacuation from Libya. Take care, Sarah.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, you can find this podcast and others at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. If you want to support us, check out Patreon.com/AmericanWarriorRadio. Take care.